All right, on to, I guess it's the second chapter in the plant unit. This one has to do with resource acquisition. That's one of the major themes, which is how plants get things into their bodies. We're looking at an opening slide here that's a lot like a lot of these opening chapter slides. They're just interesting examples. If you were to quickly look at this, you might say, well, there's just a bunch of rocks. There certainly are some rocks, but these things that kind of look like rocks, when you look at them a little closer, you realize that they aren't rocks. These are cacti, or pieces of cacti, I should say, because there's nothing real unusual about seeing a cactus growing in a place that's dry, which this is a desert. What's unusual is that these aren't just short-bodied cacti or small cacti. What you're seeing here is really just the very tips of a big organism, most of which is underground. Now, there's also nothing unusual about part of a plant's body being underground, right? The root system. But what's unusual here is that much of this underground part is really not the root system. It's the shoot system, which usually is above ground, for one thing. That's partly unusual. But also, the shoot system is really about two major things, about producing reproductive structures, but also mostly about photosynthesis, right? That's really what happens above ground where the light is. And most of the bulk of this cactus is actually below ground, so you'd think, well, it's worthless in terms of photosynthesis. But it turns out that it's actually not, because the tops of these kind of crescent-shaped structures are translucent. They let light through like little windows. And so the part that's directly exposed, all of this that you see, of course, is photosynthetic, capable of photosynthesis. But actually, so is the underground part of the cactus, because light penetrates through these little window-like lenses deep into the underground tissue of the plant and allows it to photosynthesize. Unusual, because most plants can't do that. Most plants rely on sunlight directly hitting the exposed shoot system, as you see in slide 2. This is a cartoon of a generalized plant. It doesn't matter that it's a tree, but it's a familiar example. What's important here is what's happening with the various resources that the plant needs and uses. And you can see various arrows indicating directions that these resources are traveling. Well, light is a non-material resource, of course. Light does not have mass, but light is certainly something that a plant can't live without, right? It needs light for photosynthesis. So that's coming in, and it can strike anywhere that's exposed, of course, but in a typical plant, the leaves are specially adapted to collecting that light. And like I said before, anything that's green on a plant is capable of photosynthesis. But on a lot of plants, big parts of the body aren't green, like the trunk of a tree, for instance. The greenest parts on most plants, on typical plant, are the leaves. So they're all about collecting light. That's an input of energy in the form of electromagnetic energy, which light is. There are also, though, several material resources plants require. If you think about the summary reaction for photosynthesis, of course, does not happen in one step. It's many, many biochemical reactions occurring as pathways, but it has a beginning and an end, and therefore you can summarize that whole complex set of reactions just with one reaction summary, or summary reaction that you hopefully remember from Bio 181. What is the summary reaction for photosynthesis? What are the inputs? What I mean by the summary reaction is write a chemical, a single chemical reaction that summarizes what photosynthesis does, where it begins and where it ends. What are the inputs? What does a photosynthetic organism need, in other words? Light, but I'm talking about chemicals here. We'll put in energy, though, even though it's not a material. Energy, and then what materials? Carbon dioxide, and it's going to be six of those in order for it to stoichiometrically balance. What else does plant need, or any photosynthesizer? Water, also six of those. And then that can become what? Not in one step, like I said, in many steps, but eventually the output of photosynthesis is what? Oxygen, which is also going to be six to balance it. And oxygen, from the viewpoint of photosynthesis, is kind of just a waste product, because the goal is to produce the other thing, which is what? No, it actually requires ATP to do this. Glucose or sugars. Glucose is one of them. Whoops, no longer six. Now it's just one. C6H12O6 represents monosaccharides, which can then be turned into other things. So this photosynthesis does not happen in one step like this, like I said, but this is the beginning, this is the end, so we can consider it to be like one reaction as a summary. Well, hopefully in 181, you not only studied photosynthesis, but you studied the fact that it has a reciprocal relationship with another complex set of reactions, collectively called the complete oxidation of fuel, which consists as glycolysis and cellular respiration, right? Glycolysis first and then cellular respiration. Well, what is the summary reaction for that set of pathways? Like I said, it has a reciprocal relationship with photosynthesis. So the summary is just the reverse. If you think of this top being photosynthesis, that's why I wrote it as just a half arrow going to the right. The reverse of that is complete oxidation of fuel. Where you start with the fuel, which is the sugar. You need oxygen if you're going to use cellular respiration to completely oxidize it. And you end up producing water and carbon dioxide as outputs, right? And energy is an output when you're going to the left. That's the reason that you use your fuels, right? To get the energy out of those chemical bonds and put them into the bonds of ATP. So you make ATP going to the left. That's the oxidation of the fuel, glycolysis and cellular respiration. If you're photosynthesizing, you spend ATP and you have to take energy in as sunlight in order to do the reverse. So we can see this on slide 2. A plant needs CO2 coming into the leaves. The light provides the energy, but the carbon dioxide provides what? What's the big deal about carbon dioxide for a plant? Think about those different kinds of organisms when we were talking about prokaryotes, when we went through the heterotroph and autotroph and the various subdivisions of those, right?
Oxygen?
No. It produces oxygen as a byproduct. But the reason the plant is taking in carbon dioxide is it needs a source of carbon to build organic molecules. That is the very, very important thing that photosynthesis accomplishes. Specifically, it takes carbon from an inorganic source. Carbon dioxide is considered inorganic, right? Even though it has carbon in it. And it incorporates that carbon into organic molecules. No consumer on Earth, including us, can do that. Only producers can do that. and it has a special name in chemistry. What do we call that process of incorporating inorganic carbon into organic compounds? What is that called? That is called carbon fixation. And photosynthesis is able to do that. That is a huge deal. So anyway, that's why the carbon dioxide is coming in. It's the source of carbon that will serve, along with other, many other carbons, as a carbon skeleton of an organic compound. Sugar immediately, but then once you have the sugar, once you have organic compounds produced, you can rearrange those into other organic compounds. You know, you can add nitrogen and make amino acids and so on. Okay, oxygen is coming out at the leaves because oxygen is a product of photosynthesis. Like I said, from the viewpoint of photosynthesis, it's really waste material. Just like CO2 is waste for us, right? Because once we've broken our fuel completely down and completely dismantled that carbon skeleton, six carbons in a molecule to begin with, completely dismantling it into six individual one-carbon molecules, CO2, we've gotten as much of the usable energy out of that as we can. CO2 is worthless to us for additional energy, so we get rid of it. So the photosynthesis and the oxidation of fuel are, they undo each other. That's the reciprocal relationship. Now, water is coming out of the leaves, but it's coming in to the plant at the root system. Not only the water, but minerals that are dissolved in that water. Water is a solvent, right? So what comes in is really not pure water. It's a solution of water and solutes, important minerals that the plant needs as well. And so the, look at the blue arrows representing water and minerals. This is a one-way flow and a continuous flow. Entry of water into the root system through the vessels, xylem, up through the plant's body, and then out the leaves continuously. And that continuous movement of water, like I just described, is called transpiration. Plants continuously transpire. All right, so CO2 is coming in at the leaves, oxygen is coming out because photosynthesis is going on there primarily. What about the root system, though? Notice that there you have CO2 coming out of the roots and oxygen coming into the roots. Why does that make sense? What's that all about? Why would the roots take in oxygen and give off CO2? Right. Don't ever lose track of the fact that plants, yes, they do photosynthesize because they have chloroplasts, but they also undergo cellular respiration, just like our own cells. They do both. We have mitochondria only. They have mitochondria and chloroplasts. And so in the root system, these are all living cells. They have to remain alive by undergoing glycolysis and cellular respiration. So they're breaking down their fuels just like we do, and giving off CO2 as waste. They need oxygen for that process. So it's coming in. All right? They're in the total darkness, so they're not photosynthesizing. The root system is like us. All they're doing is cellular glycolysis and cellular respiration. Whereas in the leaves, both are occurring. But if photosynthesis is outpacing glycolysis and cellular respiration, then you're going to take in more CO2 than you give off. It's a net income of CO2. Does that all make sense? Okay. Now, sugar, the only thing we haven't mentioned here in the green arrows, is the product of photosynthesis. Like I said, it can be transformed into other organic compounds. It doesn't have to stay as sugar. But sugar is carbohydrates, which is what sugar is, are the main fuels in all cells, including our own cells. We can use other things as fuel, but carbohydrates are the main fuels. And so sugars get produced where photosynthesis takes place, which is usually the leaves. That place is called a sugar source because that's where it's produced. Now, some of that sugar is used by the leaves to keep them alive, but the leaves make much more than they need by themselves. The excess is then transported through the other set of tubes, not the xylem, but the phloem, to the places that we call sugar sinks, which means places in the plant's body that need the sugar and can't produce their own. The roots are the best example of a sugar sink because they're non-photosynthetic, being in the dark, right? That sugar is the fuel. That's feeding the roots. The roots don't eat like we do. Their food is sent through the rest of their body, the part of the body that makes that food by photosynthesis. All right. Oh, the other thing, by the way, is that notice sugar has double arrows, double-headed arrows, meaning that it's not a one-way flow like it is for transpiration of water. Sugar can go back and forth depending on the need. What is considered a sugar source one part of the year might be a sugar sink another part of the year. So the flow of sugar might need to be reversed in order to feed the plant appropriately. All right, now we can go on to 3. And the main point of this slide is something that we call phyllotaxy. Now, anyone know what phyll means? Phyll. Just like in the word chlorophyll. It means leaf. Chlorophyll literally means green leaf. Phyllotaxy refers to the specific arrangement of leaves on a given plant. And so this example uses a conifer, typical gymnosperm, like a pine tree, just as an example. It's not that phyllotaxy applies only to these kinds of plants. It could be any plant. But in this example, if you just casually look at a branch of a pine tree or a spruce or a fir, you might say, well, it's just random where these leaves are coming out of the stem. Just a bunch of them, each of them randomly coming out. That's actually not true. It's not nearly random. Very highly ordered, actually. So on the big picture, which is a close-up of the upper left, we're looking at the very tip, which is the shoot apical meristem we talked about last time. And this is very, very close-up view. This is microscopic, really. But when you get really close up with a dissecting scope, or at least, you can see these little bumps, which are the very beginnings of what will eventually be leaves. They haven't developed yet. And the numbers, of course, aren't there. These have been added. But the numbers indicate the relative ages of these leaves to be, these developing leaves. And the lower the number, the younger it is. One, you can't even really see. It's not even a bump yet. But when you follow the numbers, you can see that it's not random. They're going nicely around the circumference of this branch as they get older and older. And when the primary growth occurs and makes this thing longer, that means the leaves are really making a spiral around the branch. Not random. Now, why would it be disadvantageous to be random? Which is the other way of saying, why is it advantageous for it to be a nice ordered spiral? Based on what I said, leaves' major job is in most plants. What would be the disadvantage of just having them come out wherever?
Try to be at the top, mostly so.
Well, they are at the top momentarily. Each of them is at the top for one when they're first born, in a sense. But then as it keeps getting longer, then they're left behind. If they were coming out randomly, though, then there would be a chance that one leaf would be right under another leaf, right? And therefore, it would be in the shadow of the other one. The job of the leaf is to collect sunlight. You don't want to be in the shade if you're a leaf. So by having them nicely ordered in a spiral, it makes it a maximal chance that each one will be able to receive its own sunlight. Now to four. These are cartoon cells, obviously. We're looking at one whole cell and half of a cell on either side of it, of trillions that are in a plant. Well, a big plant like a tree has probably quadrillions of cells. Certainly quadrillions of cells. We ourselves have trillions. But anyway, this is just a tiny piece of the big body of a plant, cell by cell we're looking at. And what we see here is that a plant is not as compartmentalized as you would think a multicellular organism is. You know, we tend to think of each cell as a compartment, and it is in a lot of cases. But in a plant's body, there are intercellular junctions that maybe you learned about in 181 called plasmodesmata that are like little tunnels connecting one cell to its neighbor. Plasmodesmata is a plural, by the way. Plasmodesma is the singular. But anyway, since there are plasmodesmata connecting the cells, that means instead of each cell being its own compartment with its own cytoplasm, and cytosol here, that just refers to the liquid part of the cytoplasm. Cytoplasm is collectively the stuff that's outside of the nucleus. So the cytosol is the liquid part of that. Anyway, if you had a cell the way you normally think of it, it's its own chamber with its own cytoplasm, and then even if it's butted up against another cell, that would be a separate chamber, right? But when you connect those cells with tunnels, which these plasmodesmata are, that means the cytoplasm is shared by all of the cells because they're all connected by these tunnels. And so even in a huge tree with quadrillions of cells, there's all one compartment of cytoplasm, really, because they're all connected through these plasmodesmata. And that means in the overall body of the plant, there are two distinct compartments that we can see here. One is the combination of all the cytoplasm. Okay? And that is called the symplast, which you see in the key, made up of all the cytoplasm. And then the apoplast is the extracellular compartment. The symplast is all the intracellular stuff combined as one compartment. The apoplast is all the extracellular stuff, right? Which is where the cell wall is. The cell wall is part of the apoplast. But similarly in our own body, right? You can be in an intracellular environment as inside a cell, or you can be between cells. And if you're between cells, then you are extracellular. Imagine yourself as a particle, right? For instance, your blood plasma, which is just the liquid part of your blood, that is extracellular fluid, right? It's outside of the red blood cells and all the other cells of your body. But if you're inside a cell, then you're part of intracellular fluid. That's a different compartment. Well, in a plant, you have the symplast and the apoplast, major compartments. And therefore, if you are a particle of whatever type, it doesn't matter, traveling from one part in that plant's body to another part in that same plant's body, then there are three routes you can take because of these two compartments. You can take what's called the symplastic route, the blue arrow, and that assumes that you start out in a cell, in the cytoplasm of a cell to begin with. So, for instance, if you're as a particle, you're a metabolite, a chemical that's made by some biochemistry that's happening in the plant cell. You're created inside the cell to begin with. You're already in the symplast, in other words. Therefore, you can travel through from cell to cell through these plasmodesmata, and you can go anywhere in the plant through that, remaining that entire time in the symplast. That's the symplastic route. If, on the other hand, you start outside of any of the cells, in other words, if you start out in the apoplast, you can still travel from one part of the plant to another, staying entirely in the apoplast and never actually entering one of the cells, and that would be the apoplastic route. So the only other possibility then is a combination of the two, which is what the green arrow is. And notice that's called the transmembrane route, meaning through a membrane. Trans means through or across. Transmembrane route is so called because a particle crosses a plasma membrane at least once. It could start out in either the apoplast or the symplast, but it goes into the other compartment at least once, and it might go back and forth many times like you see in the green. But if it does it at least once, that means the entire route is transmembrane because it's went through a membrane and it has spent some time in both of the two compartments. Slide 5. Well, this is entirely 181 review, but I usually get kind of deeply into this again because I find that most students forget this stuff. So I want to talk about transmembrane transport a little bit. Transmembrane transport refers to the movement of some sort of particle through a plasma membrane, either into the cell or out of the cell. And transmembrane transport is really just part of one category of transport processes that get things into and out of cells. There's three fundamentally different transport processes that get things into or out of cells. Does anyone remember what they are? One of them is called active transport. So certainly there's someone in here who can at least guess the second category. Passive transport. And both of those combined make up transmembrane transport, because in both of those cases something is going through the membrane. But there's also kind of a cheating mechanism in which you can get something either into the cell or out of the cell without it actually ever going through a membrane. That's the third category of transport processes I'm talking about. Any idea?
Sodium potassium ion pump?
That's transmembrane, because something is going directly through the membrane. But how can a cell get something into itself or out of itself without that thing actually passing through a membrane? That's why I say it's a cheating mechanism. By forming vesicles. So the third category is vesicular transport. All right. Vesicles are little bag-like structures made out of membrane, right? Vesicular transport includes two major subcategories that are based only on the direction of the movement of the particle, whether it's into or out of the cell. What are those two subcategories of vesicular transport called? What do we call inward movement of something into the cell via a vesicle? Amoebas do this, for instance. They surround something that they want to be inside them by little pseudopodia, which are false feet, just bulges of their own plasma membrane until it surrounds the particle. Then those two things fuse together because membrane kind of melts together. And that forms a vesicle around that thing. It's now inside the cell, but it never went through a membrane. That's why it's cheating. What is that process called, though? It's called endocytosis. Osis means condition, cyte means cell, endo means in. Well, the same thing, but occurring in the reverse, using a vesicle to get something out of the cell via vesicular transport, is exocytosis. And then you can subdivide endocytosis again if you want, based on what kind of thing you're taking in. Endocytosis can be either phagocytosis or pinocytosis. You remember these terms? Phagocytosis literally means cell eating because it's bringing in a solid chunk, kind of like we'll eat a sandwich. And pinocytosis literally means cell drinking. It's the same process, but it's basically just taking a little bag of liquid from the environment, like a sip of liquid. Okay, well, vesicular transport is different from the other two because the other two involves a particle actually going directly through a membrane. Now, passive transport is called passive based on the requirement for additional energy. All transport requires energy, by the way, so don't believe someone if someone tells you that passive transport doesn't require energy. It does. All moving anything requires energy. You don't get it for free. But the source of the energy for passive transport is already built into the system, so there is no need for expenditure of outside energy. What is the source of energy that drives passive transport? A gradient, exactly. A gradient, general word that just means a difference, right? There's all kinds of gradients. Like a pressure gradient is a difference in pressure from one place to another. There are concentration gradients as well, which are what we're really talking about here when we talk about passive transport into or out of a cell. And you should remember that gradients are always forms of potential energy. And therefore, a gradient can be put to work to do something for you. Just like it takes energy to haul water uphill against the gravitational gradient. That can pay off, though, if you spill that water now, let it go back down its gradient, and fall on a water wheel, turn it, which can grind corn for you, for instance, right? So the gradient is a form of stored or potential energy that can pay off. And that's what drives passive transport. So it does require energy, but it's built in. Active transport, on the other hand, requires expenditure of additional outside energy because it moves things against their gradient in the opposite way that they want to, compared to how they want to diffuse. Diffusion is passive transport. Active transport moves things in the opposite direction. So, diffusion or passive transport moves things from where there is a high concentration of that stuff to where there's a lower concentration. Active transport moves it just the opposite way. It takes it from where it's already scarce, comparatively, and then stockpiles it, moves it to a place where it's already plentiful. And that takes energy. Okay, so we also can say that when it comes to diffusion into or out of a cell, which is passive transport, diffusion is always passive. That's just another name for passive transport, really. But if a particle has a gradient, through the membrane or across the membrane. What that means is that the concentration on one side of the membrane is different from the concentration on the other side. It could be a higher concentration outside, lower concentration inside, or just the reverse. But it's not equal. That's what a gradient means. And so if that gradient is in place, then there is a tendency for diffusion. The gradient itself is that tendency. But for diffusion to actually happen, there not only has to be a gradient, but there has to be a way for that particle to get from point A to point B. And sometimes it can be blocked. So only certain types of particles, even if they are in a gradient situation, can move directly through the phospholipid bilayer of a plasma membrane, which is the bulk of the membrane, right? There's two criteria that need to be met for a particle to be eligible to diffuse directly through the phospholipid bilayer. What has to be true? What two things have to be true of that particle? The backwards way of asking that is, what kind of particle would be disqualified? What would make it unable to get through the phospholipid bilayer directly? Two things.
It has to be able to fit into the substrate, I mean.
This doesn't involve an enzyme, so it's not the substrate terminology isn't right, but you're right about size. Too big and you don't get through directly through these phospholipids. Okay? So that means to actually diffuse directly through the membrane, you have to be small enough, for one thing. But that's not enough, because there are certain things that are tiny and still don't get through very well. Like a hydrogen ion, for instance, otherwise known as a proton. What's true of a proton that makes it not very good at getting directly through the phospholipid bilayer, even though it's tiny? What do you know about a proton? It has a charge. And so does any ion, right? They're beyond polar. They're even more charged than polar. Polar things are only partially charged. Well, remember why that phospholipid bilayer formed to begin with. Because amphipathic phospholipids self-assemble into a bilayer so that the hydrophobic non-polar tails can avoid water or any other polar or charged molecule, right? So even if you're small, if you have a charge, then you're not going to want to be around these non-polar tails, and therefore that's going to keep you from going through. The things that can diffuse directly through the phospholipid bilayer, either into or out of a cell, are things that are small enough and non-polar enough. Okay, well, if you're big, or if you're polar or charged, or both, then you're going to, even if there is a gradient in place, you're not going to get through unless you have some help. And the help comes in the form of proteins. Proteins that are part of the membrane and therefore are called membrane-bound proteins. They're tied to the membrane. They're a member of the fluid mosaic. And those transport proteins help out in one way or another to get that particle through the membrane. So if that is occurring down a gradient, passively in other words, it's still diffusion. But if it requires the help of a transport protein, then it's called facilitated diffusion. Because facilitated means helped out. All right? Well, there are two categories of transport proteins that work for facilitated diffusion. And those are called channel proteins and carrier proteins. Channel proteins are proteins that are shaped in a way that make them like little tunnels, like little beads with holes. So you see one right here in cutaway view. It's like a little tunnel. It's forming a little tunnel, which just the right kind of particle that's not able to go directly through the phospholipid bilayer can still get through the membrane by going through that hollow channel. If that, you know, a channel is just open. So what is going to determine which direction the particle goes through if it's an open channel? The direction of the gradient, exactly. It's all, diffusion always occurs from high concentration of that particle to low concentration. The carrier protein, on the other hand, is a protein that doesn't just form an opening, which the channel does. It's called a carrier protein because there is a temporary binding that occurs, and then an unbinding, that's why I say temporary, between the particle and the carrier protein. Now, the general word that we give to something that binds to something else, which is that something else is usually a protein, but the thing that binds to it is generally called a ligand. To ligate means to tie or bind. That's why that word is used. So substrates, for instance, are examples of ligands because they bind to enzymes. Well, here, particles that are trying to get through the membrane are ligands if they are using a carrier protein because they bind to the carrier protein temporarily. And in general, the general consequence of a ligand binding to a protein is that the protein is going to change shape. Okay? That's true for enzymes, for instance. A substrate comes along and binds to an enzyme. The enzyme changes shape and kind of hugs that substrate even better than it was originally. But anyway, when a carrier protein binds a ligand, a particle that's trying to get through the membrane, the shape change is such that it basically drops it off on the other side of the membrane. Now, if that is happening because of a gradient, and it's going downhill in terms of concentration, then that's still a passive process. So carrier proteins can be used for passive facilitated diffusion. And of course, channel proteins can as well. But channel proteins, in addition to being able to be used passively, can also be used for active transport. And hopefully it will make sense to you that a channel protein could never be used for active transport. Because a channel is just open, right? If you make a hole in something and you have a gradient in place, just think of poking a hole in a bucket full of water, it's not going to allow water to come in, right? It's always going to come out down the gradient. If you want water to go in through that hole, you're going to have to force it through by pushing on the water. So the only kind of transport protein that can act for active transport is a carrier protein. But they can also act passively. That's the point. If a carrier protein is being used for active transport, then we call that thing either an active transporter, but more commonly a pump. When we use the word pump, that is code word for active transport. Right? You don't have to pump water downhill. It'll just fall downhill. You have to pump it uphill, though. Okay. Just a little bit more terminology. And the rest of these slides aren't going to take this long. Transporters can be uniporters or the process of transporting them can be called uniport if there's only one kind of particle being moved by that transporter. And this is whether it's passive or active transport. If a transport protein is involved, it can be uniport or it can be co-transport. And the proteins, therefore, will be called co-transporters. Co-transport is more or less simultaneous movement of two different kinds of particles. All right? Uniport moves just one type. Now, it can move many of them. It's just they're all the same type in uniport. Co-transport, you have two different kinds of particles moving. And then there are actually two subdivisions of co-transport. You can have what are called symporters, or the process is called symport. Sim meaning together, right? Symport is co-transport in which both particles, different types of particles, are moved in the same direction. They can be both moved out of the cell or both moved into the cell, but they're going together in the same direction. The only other possibility, of course, is if they're moving opposite directions, which is called antiport. So one type of particle is moving into the cell while the other type of particle is being moved out of the cell. All right, any questions on all those definitions? Well, now we can finally talk about what's happening here in the cartoons. In the upper left, we have a diagram of what is usually called just active transport, but I can call it also primary active transport simply because I can then distinguish it from what we'll talk about in a minute, which is called secondary active transport. All right, but usually we don't bother to say primary active transport, we just say active transport. Active transport, though, like I said before, by definition requires expenditure of outside additional energy. Often that comes in the form of ATP. It doesn't have to. There are other things like GTP, for instance, could be used. But it's some energy source. ATP is being used here. And so the purple thing is an active transport, otherwise known as a pump. This is an example of a proton pump because the specific type of particle that it pumps is protons. And by the way, you should equate in your mind H plus, proton, and hydrogen ion. They are all exactly the same thing, right? A hydrogen atom is a proton and an electron. If it loses that electron, all you have is a proton left. But we can call it a hydrogen ion, or we can symbolize it as H plus. Well, we have proton pumps in our bodies as well that are important for various things, but most prevalent in animal bodies, as opposed to plants, are what are called sodium-potassium exchange pumps. We have these in all of our living cells, and they're continuously busy for your entire life, using a lot of your energy. By some estimates, about 40% of your energy budget, 40% of the reason you have to eat, is to keep those sodium-potassium exchange pumps pumping continuously, which is really important for various reasons, including your entire nervous system and muscular system operate on this directly. You can't have nerve impulses and you can't have muscular impulses without sodium-potassium exchange pumps. Anyway, plants don't use those. They use proton pumps primarily to do all kinds of things. We're going to talk about just one specific example, but in this upper left, the only thing that's being accomplished here directly is the pumping of protons. And notice that the protons are being pumped out of the cell. And you can tell it's pumping because they're moving from a place where there's already a lower concentration to a place where there's already a higher concentration. That's against the gradient. Okay, now what did I say before about gradients that you shouldn't forget? They are a source of potential energy, right? So ATP has been spent here. That's energy, right? Valuable stuff you don't want to waste. Some of that energy is lost as heat because you can't do anything about the second law of thermodynamics. But a lot of the energy that was in that ATP that got spent is now in the form of a proton gradient that has been established by pumping them. Anyway, that's just primary active transport. So you might think, why does it want to pump protons out? It's not really so much to get protons out as it is to create the gradient and therefore use that gradient as a source of energy to do something else. So it's just a middleman. It's changing hands. The energy is changing hands from ATP to proton gradient. Okay, so that brings us then to the upper right, which is secondary active transport. The transporter is the only thing shown in this picture, but it's really right beside the primary pump that we just looked at. Same slice of membrane. There's millions of copies of both of these. But this is a different protein, and it's specifically acting as a co-transporter, right? Because there's two different kinds of particles being moved here. And even more specifically, it's acting as a symporter, because these two different kinds of particles are both being moved in the same direction, namely into the cell in this example, right? Based on these definitions I gave you. But not only that, it's acting as a pump because it's moving sucrose, which we know is table sugar, but it's the main sugar that gets transported from one part of the plant to another, the green arrows in that figure. Sucrose is being pumped because it's being taken from outside where it's lower concentration and pumped inside where it's already higher concentration. Sucrose is going against its gradient, in other words. But you can never get that for free. The only way you can move something against its gradient is to add energy, to pump it, in other words, via active transport. But notice that there is no ATP being spent here. So what is the source of energy that's driving the pumping of sucrose? The proton gradient that was established by the first pump, which did use ATP. Okay? So this is a symporter. It only operates as a carrier transport. I mean, a carrier protein, if both types of particles are present. So it needs protons. And protons, by the way, in this case are diffusing, which is passive, right? Protons are going back into the cell because that's where they want to go, from where they got pumped from. I mean, to where they got pumped from. Right? They want to go down their gradient. But what makes them unable to go directly through the plasma membrane? Or the phospholipid bilayer? Because they are, even though they're tiny, just a proton, they are fully charged particles. So they don't want to be around these hydrophobic tails. So they get back into the cell through the only places where they can get through, which are these purple co-transporters. And it's a carrier protein. When the proton comes in and binds, it allows for a sucrose also to come along and bind. And so as hydrogen ions diffuse back into the cell, it drags sucrose along for the ride against its gradient. So the sucrose is being pumped, but the energy for pumping it is the diffusion of protons. The source of energy was the proton gradient. That's why it's called secondary active transport. So some source of energy, like ATP, is used to set up a gradient to begin with, and then that gradient is used to drive the pumping of some other particle. Okay? We use this all the time, but plants do as well. And in this case, it's to get sucrose inside the cell. But it can be used for a lot of different things, which is why these proton pumps are versatile. Okay, well, C is just another example. Here you have a proton pump. You don't see the proton pump, but the proton pump has already established the gradient, and that gradient of protons is now used to bring in nitrate ions, which are important for plants. So it's not just sucrose, is the point. And D is just a picture of an ion channel. We've already talked about that. Channels are always passive, right? Because they're open. They don't grab onto the thing, so they can't force it in the opposite direction. Okay. Six. Well, passive transport is diffusion, but sometimes we use the word osmosis, which is really just a special case of diffusion. Osmosis is always diffusion, but there's a reason why we give it a special name. There's two things that have to be true for the diffusion to be osmosis. One is that the particle that is diffusing is not a solute, which it usually is when we use the word diffusion. Instead, it is a solvent particle. Now, do you remember the difference between these? A solution is a type of mixture. A solution consists of solvent and solute. The solvent is the thing that dissolves the other thing. The solute is the thing being dissolved by the solvent. And so in biology, I mean, there's all kinds of solvents in chemistry, but in biology, the solvent is always water. Which is why biology texts will say osmosis is water movement. Technically, it could be any solvent, but in biology, that's always water. But anyway, that's one requirement. That's not enough by itself. But if it's water that's moving instead of a solute particle, and it's moving down its own gradient, then it could be osmosis. It definitely is osmosis if it's water or solvent moving through a membrane. For instance, you know, if you put a sugar cube into a cup of water, you have two different kinds of particles. And they're both going to diffuse down their own gradients, but in opposite directions, right? The water's going to diffuse to where the sugar is. The sugar is going to diffuse to where the water is. But neither of them passes a membrane. So that's really just diffusion of water and diffusion of sugar. If, on the other hand, you have a membrane separating two compartments and water goes through down its gradient, then that is osmosis. All right? And osmosis is important for plants to maintain, well, all organisms, but what we're studying here is plants, to maintain proper pressure inside the cell, for one thing. Psi is a Greek letter. This is a capital Psi. Looks like a pitchfork. It's the symbol that means pressure. And there are two components of it. Psi sub P is just hydrostatic pressure based on how, basically it's what you think of as pressure. You know, the more water you have in a compartment, the more pressurized it is. Psi sub S for solute, is osmotic pressure, which is pressure based on the tendency for osmosis to occur. All right, now I have to give you some more quick definitions, hopefully quick. This should be review too, but like I said, people forget this. Tonicity. What about this word tonicity? What does that refer to? Tonicity refers to the tendency for osmosis to occur into or out of a cell. And so there are three degrees of tonicity that you're probably more familiar with than the word tonicity. The three degrees of tonicity are hypotonicity or hypotonic environment, isotonic, and hypertonic. You've heard these, right? And these are often misused, so be careful with these. None of these three words should ever be used to describe a cell. They're only ever used to describe the cell's environment. All right? That's one thing. But a confusing thing about it is that they are named for solutes, even though the solutes are not moving, it's the solvent that's moving. So let me quickly say, make sense of this. Hypo means what by itself as a prefix?
Low.
Low, below. Like hypodermic, right? Below the skin. A hypotonic solution or environment, which is the outside of the cell, is called hypotonic because the solute concentration outside that cell is lower than inside the cell. That's what I mean by the prefixes are describe the solutes, even though it's not the solutes that are moving, it's the solvent. So, all that really matters is the wateriness for osmosis. Because water moves by osmosis always from where it's more watery to where it's less watery. But a hypotonic environment, by having a lower solute concentration than the cell's own solution, is really just a backwards way of saying that that hypotonic solution is more watery, right? If it has a low solute concentration, that means it's mostly solvent. So a hypotonic environment is more watery than the cell. And therefore, as always happens, water is going to move from where it's more watery to where it's less watery. But in this case, that means it's going to move into the cell, right? Hypotonic environment is going to cause osmosis to move water into the cell. That's true for any cell, whether it's plant or not. Hypertonic is just the opposite. Hyper means above. That's referring to the solute concentration, even though that's not what's moving. So saying that a hypertonic environment has a higher concentration of solutes is really a backwards way of saying that a hypertonic solution is less watery than the cell. Right? If it's really salty, for instance, that means it's not very watery compared to pure water. Once again, water is going to move down its gradient from where it's more watery to where it's less watery. But if the cell is surrounded by a hypertonic environment, less watery environment, then the water is going to leave the cell and go outside by osmosis. And in iso means same as a prefix. So an isotonic environment is really an environment that has the same overall solute concentration. Even though they might be totally different kinds of solutes, it doesn't matter because they're not the ones that are moving. But if you think about it, if you have a 2 molar sugar concentration on one side and a 2 molar other kind of sugar, let's say, two different kinds of solutes, sugar and salt for that matter, on the other side of the membrane, even though they are totally different kinds of solutes, the fact that their concentrations are equal mean the two environments are equally watery. And that's really what matters. If they're equally watery or isotonic, then there is no tendency for water to go one direction more than the other. Okay. Well, you see all three of these instances in this picture. If a plant is surrounded by a hypertonic environment, meaning less watery than the plant itself, then osmosis is going to move water out of the cell. And that's going to be bad for the cell. It's bad for any cell, really. If your own cells are in a hypertonic environment, they'll lose water as well. You're an animal, though, right? That animal cell only has a plasma membrane. No cell wall outside of that. The plasma membrane's pretty flimsy, so it will just shrink up, which will kill it eventually if it's severe enough. That shrinkage of an animal cell in a hypertonic environment is called crenation. Plant cells don't undergo crenation, or we don't use that word, because they have a tough cell wall exterior to the plasma membrane. So the plasma membrane is like the paint on the interior wall of a room. The actual structural wall is like the cell wall. The flimsy plasma membrane is like the layer of paint. And so when in a hypertonic environment, a plant cell, by losing that water, will shrink its plasma membrane away from, it'll peel it away from the cell wall, which will also kill that plant cell. And that is not called crenation in that case, even though it's the same thing happening. It's called plasmolysis. If a plant cell is in an isotonic environment, which doesn't, remember, it can be totally different kinds of solutes outside, but if it's equally watery than the cell itself, then water is going to enter the cell and leave the cell at the same rate. And it's not going to gain or lose any volume. But it's going to be flaccid or limp because it's not holding as much water as it can. All right. Well, that's actually the ideal situation for our own cells, because that keeps them from shrinking or rupturing. So for an animal cell, the ideal situation, the ideal environment is an isotonic one. A plant will survive that, but it's not its ideal situation. The ideal situation for a plant is a hypotonic environment, meaning more watery than the plant cell itself. And that's because water is going to come into the cell. Well, for an animal cell, that's going to kill the cell, because that flimsy plasma membrane will eventually explode. It'll just burst. Which, by the way, is called lysis. Plant cells don't undergo lysis, though, in a hypotonic environment, because they have this strong cell wall exterior to the plasma membrane holding the pressure in. So they swell up or become turgid, which is just another word for swollen, keeping the plasma membrane nicely against the cell wall, for one thing, that's one good thing. But also, that cell is not in isolation, remember. Plants are multicellular. So you have trillions and trillions of cells. If they're all taking up water simultaneously and they're all becoming turgid, that means they're all pressing on each other, right? And that's going to cause an erection. Very similar to a penis erection, except it's not blood pressure causing it, it's osmotic pressure because of intake of water into the cells. But this is why a plant that doesn't have any wood structure in it can still stand upright. It's an erection caused by intake of water osmotically in a hypotonic environment. Well, like this healthy plant on the right, it's turgid. The cells are turgid. Of course, you've probably all forgotten to water a plant one time in your life for a little too long and it starts wilting. If you catch it in time, it's wilted because, once it takes in so much water, eventually it's no longer going to be a hypotonic environment. Eventually the environment becomes less watery and the plant will actually lose water. And therefore their cells are not pushing on each other. It's limp. If that's not too drastic, you can simply rescue it by watering it and it'll go back to being erect. But it could kill it. Okay, anyway, let's go to slide 8. Now hopefully we can speed up on in terms of per slide. In slide 8, we're looking at the technique of hydroponics, hydroponic growing of plants. Hydroponics refers to growing plants instead of growing them in soil, which they do naturally in most species. They're grown in solutions of water. The root systems are in just watery solutions, no solid particles, no soil. And the reason this is useful for botanists, scientists who study plants, is that soil is a very difficult thing to actually manipulate scientifically. In a scientific experiment, you want to change only one variable at a time, right? Well, it's very difficult to do that in soil because it is a very complex mixture of things. But in a hydroponic solution, it can be a very complex mixture of things, but it's very easy to change it out and change only one component of that mixture, right? You can flush it out, start new with something that's just like it, except one thing is missing. You can't do that with soil. So by doing this and looking at the reaction of the plants, when you change one component at a time, or eliminate one component at a time, then you can start to realize what are the things that the plant absolutely needs to live. So this hydroponic technique is a way of compiling what we have in slide 9, which is a table of essential elements in plants. Elements here means chemical elements, what you think of as elements, the things that are on the periodic table, right? So these aren't compounds. These are elements. And really the list is very similar to our own list of essential elements. They're essential because we absolutely cannot live without them. They're largely the same because we've evolved together. It's basically very similar for all organisms, but plants have a... this is the specific list for plants determined by hydroponics. Notice, though, that even though these are all essential, they can be classified as either macronutrients or micronutrients based on how much you need. So just because you need something doesn't mean you need a hell of a lot of it. Micronutrients are definitely essential, but you need just a tiny amount to stay alive. In fact, more is sometimes bad. Macronutrients, on the other hand, you not only need, but you need plenty of them to stay alive. And they shouldn't surprise you what they are. Carbon, well, all four biological macromolecule categories are organic, right? They all have carbon in them. In fact, they all have carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen in them, which is why those are the first three biggies. That would be on our own list as well. So, by the way, what are those four categories of biological macromolecules? We've talked about this before, haven't we? What are all organisms? What biological macromolecule simply means a big molecule. So water is a molecule, but it doesn't count as a macromolecule. Any living thing, not just plants, any organism is made of four categories of biological macromolecules. What are they? Proteins is one. Lipids. Nucleic acids. What's the fourth?
Monosaccharides.
They're not big. I'm not going to accept carbohydrates, even though some people will say that, because the word carbohydrate is too general. It doesn't mean big, necessarily. He said monosaccharides, which is an example of a carbohydrate, but a monosaccharide is not a macromolecule because it's a small molecule. So carbohydrates can be big or small. What is the specific name for large carbohydrates, which are macromolecules? Polysaccharides. Yeah, so those are the four. Polysaccharides, nucleic acids, which can also be called polynucleotides, proteins, which can also be called polypeptides, and lipids. Those all have carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen in them. Two of them also have nitrogen, which is why that's the fourth on the list, not just for plants, but for us as well. Which of those four have nitrogen in as well? A lot of 181 review tonight. Nucleic acids do. So think about what a nucleic acid is. It's a polymer, meaning that you string together a bunch of monomers. What are the monomers called that make up nucleic acids? Remember just a bit ago I said nucleic acid can also be called polynucleotides? That's because the monomers that they're made out of, that you string together, are called nucleotides. Each individual nucleotide has, even though it's one part in itself, it really has three parts to it. A pentose, sugar, which depending on whether it's DNA or RNA is either deoxyribose or ribose. And then two things that are connected to that pentose sugar. One of which is a nitrogenous base, right? Adenine, guanine, cytosine, thymine, and uracil, you remember these? Those are all nitrogenous bases because they all have nitrogen in them. So without nitrogen, you can't have any DNA or RNA. Pretty important, right? Impossible to think of an organism without them. But that third thing, component of a nucleotide, by the way, the other thing that's connected to that same pentose sugar besides the nitrogenous base is a phosphate. Which is why phosphorus, just one reason why phosphorus is so important, and that's in here as a macronutrient as well. I'm not going to go through this whole list, but there's multiple reasons why each of these is vital. The micronutrients, on the other hand, which you just need a trace amount of, in a lot, most of which are metal ions. A lot of the way the metal ions that are micronutrients operate, not only in plants but in us too, is that they are cofactors. Cofactors are inorganic particles that need to hook on to enzymes to make them work. Enzymes are truly important, of course. But if an enzyme doesn't work as a catalyst, it's no use having that enzyme. So a lot of enzymes, which are proteins, don't have these metal ions in them as the raw protein, but when that metal ion is connected to it, it will start acting as the enzyme. It will be activated, in other words, as a functional enzyme. So this whole list, like I said, was determined by one at a time eliminating one of these things and seeing how well the plant did. Some things you can eliminate and they do well, those aren't essential elements. So in slide 10, using corn as an example, if you don't recognize this as corn, it is. By looking at these leaves, what kind of angiosperm is corn? It's a monocot because of the leaf venation, right? It has parallel venation, not branched. But anyway, if you know enough about corn, well, you can, even without knowing about corn, you can kind of tell the top one is healthy. But if you start seeing these different colors, you know something's going wrong. And if you know enough about corn, you can tell just by looking at it what it probably is lacking. The point is, if it's lacking any one of those essential elements, it's going to suffer and eventually die if it doesn't have any of it. Okay, let's go to 11. Now, this is a very, very, very close-up cartoon, because after all, these are protons, so very, very close up. You don't even see a cell here. This root hair is just a tiny extension of one cell that would be bigger than the building. But the blue background, even though you don't see particles, is water molecules. They are part of what we call the soil solution. Soil, if it's healthy soil, has some water in it. But it's not pure water, right? Water is the solvent, and dissolved in that are various solutes. So the wet part of the soil is collectively called the soil solution, because it is an aqueous solution. Water and solutes. And you see many ionic solutes right here. Potassium, calcium, magnesium. These are solutes in the soil solution. And notice that they all happen to be positively charged ions, otherwise known as what? What are positive ions called? Cations. Plants, just like our own bodies, need these positively charged ions for various things. And so they take these in as part of the soil solution in transpiration, assuming that they're available. Well, soil itself, the solid part of the soil, not the solution, but the solids, is a heterogeneous mixture of a lot of different kinds and sizes of particles, like little pieces of sand or whatever. These particles tend to be negatively charged on their exterior surface. And opposite charges, opposite electrostatic charges attract each other, right? So these positively charged cations that the plant wants to take into its body are held in place, sticking to these soil particles that are negatively charged. That makes it hard for the plant to get these cations into its body. That's a problem, in other words. And so the plant solves this by a technique that is called cation exchange. In an exchange, something is traded, right? So what the plant is doing is giving up protons or hydrogen ions which are cations themselves, positively charged, and trading them for the ones that the soil particle is hanging on to. Protons do a good job of swapping because they are much smaller than any other ion, right? They're the smallest possible ion. It's just a proton, smaller than any atom. And so they can get right up in there, right between any bigger ion and the soil particle, and shield the charge from it, basically, and free it, free the potassium and the magnesium and the calcium, so that they are just now free in solution and can be taken up by the root hair. That's cation exchange. What I haven't talked about, though, is this reaction, which really should be written as a reversible reaction, but it's moving to the right in this case. What do we have here? H2O, which is water, right? And carbon dioxide. If those two mix, what do you have? H2CO3, what is that? That's carbonic acid, which of course is an acid. And acids, in the presence of water, do not stay as acids, right? They dissociate in water. That's what acids are defined as, really. Things that dissociate in water and split up into a proton and whatever is left over. So when carbonic acid dissociates, it forms hydrogen ions and the rest of the molecule, which is HCO3 minus bicarbonate ion. All right? But the importance of this to this cation exchange is that that means protons get produced as long as the roots are giving out CO2, which we talked about earlier. They are, just as a natural course of living, because they're undergoing cellular respiration, producing the CO2. So that CO2 that comes out mixes with the water, creates carbonic acid that then splits into bicarbonate ions and protons, and the protons are used to free up the other cations for the plant. There's another source of protons, though, in addition to this reaction, and that is that the root hair is also pumping protons out through proton pumps to make it even more efficient. That costs it some energy, of course, but it's worth it because it gets these essential elements into its body. By the way, this is kind of off topic because we're talking about plants here, but this is an important reaction in your own body, especially when you write it as a reversible reaction. Double arrows for all those arrows. This is an important part of your buffer system in your blood. You know, when you're... most people, if you just randomly poll them from the streets, would say that a person can only hold its breath for so long, will be forced to breathe eventually because they run out of oxygen. That's not true. There's still quite a bit of oxygen in your blood by the time you're forced to breathe. What forces you to breathe, actually, is the acidification of your blood. So when you're normally breathing, you're getting rid of the CO2 that's being dumped into the blood continuously by the cells of your body from cellular respiration. Right? If you intentionally quit breathing, hold your breath, your cells don't stop producing CO2. They're still dumping the same amount into the blood. The blood is still coming to your lungs, but you're not breathing off any of that CO2. So it's staying in the blood. And therefore, more and more CO2 is going to react with more and more water in the plasma of the blood to form carbonic acid, which will then split into bicarbonate ions and protons, hydrogen ions. And when the hydrogen ion concentration increases, that is the same thing as a decrease in pH. That's what pH is, right? It's a scale for the concentration of hydrogen ions. So that means your blood gets more acidic. And it doesn't have to change by much at all, because the base of your brain, which the blood is always reaching, is so exquisitely sensitive to a tiny change in pH that as soon as it starts to drop, it forces muscles to force you to breathe. You can't do anything about it. And so that's what causes you to breathe. On the other hand, if you intentionally hyperventilate, Even though you're sitting there, you don't have to be breathing that hard at all, right? If you intentionally hyperventilate, then you're blowing off too much CO2. And the whole thing, by Le Chatelier's principle, is going to be reversed. You're taking off CO2 from the left side, and so to replace it, everything moves to the left, which means carbonic acid has to split into CO2 and water to make up for the lost CO2. And to make up for the lost carbonic acid, bicarbonate ions and hydrogen ions have to come together to make bicarbonate. That takes hydrogen ions out of solution, which makes your blood too alkaline. The pH is now too high, which is also bad. And that's why your body's not going to let you do that forever either. You'll eventually pass out if you keep trying that. But when you pass out, that's exactly what you should do. You stop breathing for a while. That lets the CO2 build up to normal levels again. All right, back to plants, slide 12. This is all about nitrogen, which is vitally important for all organisms because you can't have proteins. Oh, by the way, that was the answer. I never finished answering that question. You said nucleic acids have nitrogen. That's true. The other one of the macromolecules that has nitrogen is proteins because every amino acid has nitrogen in it. Amino, by the way, means nitrogen containing. That's why nitrogen is vitally important for all organisms on Earth. Because they have to have proteins, they have to have nucleic acids. You can't live without either one of those. It's kind of ironic for us terrestrial animals, by the way, because being terrestrial, the fluid that surrounds us is air rather than water, like in the ocean. And that air is mostly nitrogen. 3/4 of the mixture we call air is pure nitrogen, N2. But even though we're literally bathed in nitrogen, we cannot use any of that nitrogen for our own bodies. Did we talk about this when we were in the... I don't remember if we did this time around. This is one of the many reasons why we absolutely cannot live without bacteria. Because even plants can't use that nitrogen either. There's only a few species on the planet that are able to use elemental nitrogen as a nitrogen source, even though all organisms vitally need nitrogen. What is the problem, by the way, with an N2 molecule? What makes it so out of reach of organisms in its pure form like that? What is it? It is a gas, but that by itself is not what makes it unusable. N2, what is the valence of nitrogen? The valence is how many additional electrons it has to take on in order to satisfy its outer shell, right? Another way of thinking about it, though, is the valence is how many bonds it's going to have to make. The valence of carbon is 4, which is why carbon is always making 4 bonds total, whether it's 4 single bonds, 2 double bonds, or a triple bond and a single bond. It all adds up to 4. Nitrogen has a valence of 3. So that's true for both of the nitrogen atoms in a nitrogen molecule, which is why the bond between the two nitrogens in an N2 is a triple bond. The strongest possible covalent bond, and therefore the hardest to break. And so that's why nitrogen is inert for most things. We're surrounded by it, but can't use it. Thankfully for us, because we wouldn't exist without it, there are bacteria that are able to break that bond and do the same thing to nitrogen, incorporate it into a biomolecule that photosynthesizers are able to do with carbon. Remember I called that carbon fixation? Well, nitrogen fixation is analogous to that. You take nitrogen from pure nitrogen and you fix it into or incorporate it into a nitrogen-containing compound. Not even all bacteria can do this, just certain species, but they are called nitrogen-fixing bacteria. Over here we have the plant. It absolutely needs the nitrogen, but it can't be in the form of nitrogen. It has to be in the form of either nitrate ion or ammonium ion. And bacteria are responsible for both of these, actually. So there are nitrogen-fixing bacteria that can convert pure nitrogen into ammonia. Ammonia doesn't last long in the soil, though, because the soil solution has protons in it. And so a proton from the soil will convert the ammonia into ammonium ion, NH4+. Well, some of that ammonium goes right into the plant. Like I said, the two major sources for nitrogen for plants are ammonium and nitrate. Ammonium, though, does not get taken in as well by the plant. Some does, as you see here. Its preferred type of nitrogen is nitrate. That comes in much more easily. And so some of the ammonium, the rest that's not taken up by the plant, then gets changed by other species of bacteria called nitrifying bacteria into nitrite. And then that nitrite gets converted by still other species of bacteria in the soil into nitrate, NO3-. And that's the favorite kind of nitrogen for plants, though that goes in. That's how most of it gets taken in, nitrate. Yeah. Nitrogen in the atmosphere, just pure nitrogen. Some of which pervades the soil where these bacteria are, and they convert the nitrogen-fixing bacteria, make it into ammonia. That gets converted by protonation from protons in the soil into ammonium. Some of that goes into the plant, but some of that ammonium gets transformed into nitrite, which then gets transformed into nitrate, and that is the bulk of the nitrogen that enters the plant. Ironically, even though nitrate is the preferred nitrogen source for entering the plant's body, as soon as it gets in the plant's body, it gets turned back into ammonium, NH4. It just needs to be nitrate to get in there well, but ammonium is the main form of transporting nitrate within the body of the plant from one place to the other. Okay, and by the way, there are still other species of bacteria that reverse the process and complete the loop. Denitrifying bacteria can convert nitrate back into pure nitrogen to complete the cycle. And all organisms rely on these bacteria. We wouldn't exist without them because we need that nitrogen in organic form or in biomolecule form, I should say, not necessarily organic because ammonium, for instance, isn't organic, right? It doesn't have any carbon in it. But what were you going to ask?
Can this bacteria only be found underground?
Well, no, that's just where they're operating mostly. I mean, bacteria can exist in the air, but they're never really in the air long. They kind of just get sprayed around and then land eventually because they are much heavier than the gas particles. But they're doing their job in the soil or at a surface. Okay. Oh, by the way, speaking of these two major types of nitrogen that plants take up, this happens naturally by natural I mean an ecosystem without humans. But now we've artificially overdo this process massively by using ammonium nitrate. That's what we spill onto fields, right? Ammonium nitrate is the two types of nitrogen that plants need to get into their bodies. And we give them a massive overdose of it, so a lot of it gets wasted and goes into rivers, causing problems we'll talk about later. Okay, 13. Speaking of nitrogen, we're looking here at the root system of a plant that kind of looks sick. It looks like it has cancer or something. These nodules are not abnormal. Those are normal for this type of plant. We see these mostly in plants, a group of plants called legumes, including things like soybeans and peanuts. Those are legumes. These nodules are another example of endosymbiosis. Remember, we looked at the flashlight fish, or the headlight fish, I mean, things in the guts of cows are examples of endosymbiosis. We've looked at several examples already. This is another. There are nitrogen-fixing bacteria that live inside the nodules of these legume roots. And that means the process that I just talked about in the previous slide is much more efficient in this type of, for these types of plants, compared to leaving it to just what's happening in the soil. It's really bringing it right into the plant's body. And it's so efficient that that really nitrifies the soil. You know, you probably have learned some point in your life that even if you've never really farmed or anything, if you keep growing the same crop year after year without supplementing the soil with anything, it eventually will get, it'll lose its nitrogen and you can't grow anything anymore. And you can do what we typically do nowadays, which is just dump artificially a bunch of ammonium nitrate on it. That will solve the problem in a sense. But you can also naturally do that by rotating crops and every once in a while plant peanuts, for instance, a legume or some other legume, instead of another crop that robs it of nitrogen, because all the bacteria in these nodules will provide nitrogen naturally to the soil, and then you can go back to planting something else and it will stay alive because there's nitrogen there. Usable nitrogen, I should say. Okay, 14. Here we have something we talked about before, but I didn't really tell you the detail that we're showing here. In both the top and the bottom, we have mycorrhizae. Remember we talked about this? Myco means fungus, remember? And rhize means root. So the word literally means fungus root, but it's the symbiotic relationship between a fungus and the plant root. And they both, it's not only symbiotic, it's mutualistic. They both benefit from that arrangement, right? Well, we talked about that before, but what we didn't talk about at the time is that there are two major categories of mycorrhizae: ectomycorrhizae and arbuscular mycorrhizae. Ecto means outside, and as you can see, in ectomycorrhizae, there's a thick mat on the outside of the root as a whole, but there's not all that much penetration between the cells of that root. On the other hand, in arbuscular mycorrhizae, that's the picture that we first looked at when I gave you the word mycorrhizae to begin with. Remember I was talking about the little hands like trying to penetrate a rubber balloon, a water balloon, I mean. They don't actually penetrate the plasma membrane, but the plasma membrane wraps around the fingers. Well, arbuscular means tree-like. Arbor Day is a day you plant trees, right? So arbuscular means like a tree, referring to these branched arrangements that look like little hands. And so it's not as thick a mat on the outside, but actually arbuscular mycorrhizae, even though it would look thin if you didn't cut into the root, it actually has a lot more surface area of contact between it and the plant, between the fungus and the plant, than ectomycorrhizae do. But they are both really important, and effectively all plants have mycorrhizae. And their importance of that is shown in 15. Here we have an invasive plant species. Invasive species means it's not supposed to live there naturally. It was introduced either accidentally or intentionally, but whatever the case, it's not supposed to be here. It's naturally lived somewhere else, but not here. What does naturally live here, even though it's not shown in the picture, are three kinds of trees that we see here: sugar maple, red maple, and white ash. And they were living comfortably before this invasive species came along, but started doing poorly once this invasive species did come along. And so the data are trying to indicate what the problem could be. Well, what they did to test was sterilize soil. Invaded means that the invasive species there, uninvaded means before it was there. If you sterilize the soil, whether it's invaded or uninvaded, then you don't get very much plant growth of these trees. That's what the low bars mean. which is not surprising. You sterilize soil, you're killing everything in the soil, right? If you don't sterilize it and you compare invaded to uninvaded, the uninvaded soil is much better for the trees that naturally live there. And so the idea is that maybe what's happening is the invasive species is changing the soil makeup, adding something to the soil that is actually causing these trees not to do well. And one thing that is natural to assume could be to blame is that something that this invasive species is producing is affecting the symbiotic relationship of the mycorrhizae between the fungi and the tree roots. Well, you can see this in the bottom graph. Mycorrhizal colonization is much lower for all three of the tree species if this invasive species is there. So some chemical it's producing is disturbing the mycorrhizae, and this just shows you how dependent the plants are on the fungi, the mycorrhizal relationship. 16. The specific example doesn't matter here, but this is an example of an epiphyte. Now, phyte means plant. And epi means on or over, like the epidermis is over the dermis, right? Or it's on it. An epiphyte is a plant that lives on another plant. So it might look like these are just leafy branches of a tree. The tree is one species. These green things are epiphytes that are the different species living on the first species. And so, obviously, this is a good relationship for the epiphyte. It might be neutral or bad for the other plant. It just depends on the situation. It's another example of a symbiosis. It's probably not mutualistic, though. It probably benefits only one. Even if it's parasitic, though, which is symbiosis in which one species benefits and the other gets hurt in the situation, an epiphyte is not actually physically tapping into the resources. So it doesn't grow into the body of the host plant. It's simply using it as a place to grow. On the other hand, there are such things as parasitic plants, as we see in slide 17. Plants that not only grow on other plants, but tap into their vessels and therefore steal water or nutrients from them. Mistletoe is an example. The mistletoe is not part of this tree. It's parasitizing the tree. It's a plant. The mistletoe is a plant, so it's still capable of photosynthesis, but it supplements that self-feeding with tapping into the resources of a host plant. On the other hand, there are some parasitic plants that do so well by stealing from their hosts that they've given up evolutionarily on photosynthesis, which is why they aren't green. This orange thing is just getting its nutrients from the plant, and this white one, that's even more extreme. Weird color for a plant, right? Well, it's not photosynthesizing at all. It's getting all its nutrients underground from the root system that it is tapped into as a parasite. So that's an unusual ecological situation for a plant. Most plants are producers. Another unusual lifestyle for a plant is as a carnivorous plant. Carnivorous means meat-eating, right? Most plants don't eat meat because they feed themselves via photosynthesis. But there are many species of carnivorous plants that supplement their photosynthetic input of nutrients by occasionally digesting a bug, or usually they're insects or some small creature, that fall into their traps. There's many different kinds of traps, like pitcher plants are really just like little pitchers that they can get into, but once they get to the bottom, into that watery enzyme-filled bottom, they can't crawl out. It's too slippery. And then they just get digested. More active ones are like Venus fly traps that they have a hair trigger mechanism that when that gets activated, they just close shut, and then it takes a while to digest them, but the insect is trapped, it can't get out, so it doesn't matter if it takes time. Others are sticky, that's what the sundew was. Okay, 19. The cutaway view here is at, this is through a root. This is a cross section of a root made up of many cells, as you see. And we already talked about the apoplastic and symplastic route. Remember I said that if you were a particle trying to get from one place in the cell's body to another, you can take any of those three routes. Well, a root, a true root, not a rhizoid, which is in a non-vascular plant, but a true root, which you have in a vascular plant, is not only for keeping that thing embedded in the ground, it's really its main job is to bring in water and dissolved nutrients, dissolved minerals, right? And deliver it to the rest of the plant, the shoot system. It's able to do that if it's a true root because a true root is vascular. So the transpiration I was talking about, remember, that's water coming into the cells and then making it to the vascular system in the roots, the xylem, that delivers that water all the way up to the leaves. A plant wants certain things in its body, but it also wants to keep other things that could get into it from the soil out of the plant's body. So if a particle is whether it's traveling either by the apoplastic or the symplastic, or for that matter, a transmembrane route, it doesn't matter because eventually it will get to the core of the root where the vessels are, and surrounding that vascular tissue, shown in red in the cartoon here, is a ring of cells that have things that are very similar to what in animals are called tight junctions, which are complexes of proteins acting like little walls. Your skin has these, by the way, which is why your skin is waterproof. In a plant, it's called a Casparian strip, named after some dead dude named Casper. But this complex of proteins blocks the apoplastic route. So if you're something that can't get into a cell, you can go all the way up to that Casparian strip via the apoplastic route. You're never inside a cell if you're in the apoplast, right? But eventually you're going to make it then and hit a wall. And you can't get into the vessel, therefore, and that's going to keep you from getting to the rest of the plant. Only things that are able to enter a cell and therefore be in the symplast can actually go through the cells that are connected by the Casparian strip and therefore get into the vessels. So this is a good way to control things because the plant can control what things can get into or out of cells, in other words, enter the symplast, and it doesn't matter that it can't as much control the apoplast because the apoplast leads to a dead end. Now to 20. The right edge is what I want to focus on right here. It's a very extreme close-up view of what's happening in a leaf. So this is a close-up of just this part, and these are close-ups of that. So this is so close-up that we're seeing things at the molecular level. These brownish circles are proteins, basically. The blue is liquid water background, and the blue dots, of course, are water molecules in the gas phase. What is the difference, by the way, between a gas and a liquid? Chemically speaking. Well, they're both moving. Yes, if all other things are equal, the gas particles will be moving faster. That's true. But you can slow down gas molecules as well. How can you tell whether a sample is a gas or a liquid? Because you can have a hot solid and a cold gas.
Space between
exactly. That is the only difference, really, between a liquid and a gas. You know, if you have liquid water and gaseous water or water vapor, they are exactly the same chemical, right? It's the same molecules. But in the gas phase, they're way spaced out. In the liquid, they're close together, or a solid, even closer together. But anyway, individual water molecules can change state. Now, an individual molecule you would never say is liquid, gas, or solid. That only makes sense for a population of molecules, right? Because of the spacing is what matters. But an individual water molecule can be part of a liquid population and then leave that population, go off on its own in the vapor phase, right? We call that evaporation. Well, that's part of transpiration. Remember the continuous movement of water? Even though I said that water enters the roots and then exits or leaves at the leaves, that one-way movement is not actually a pushing of water from the soil. It's really a pulling of water from the canopy, from the leaves. And it's driven by evaporation. So evaporation is what we see happening here. The blue background is liquid water molecules. I mean, a liquid population of water molecules. Some of them are evaporating into the atmosphere. All right? When that happens, of course, you're removing material from the liquid population. They're being blown off, and now you have fewer liquid molecules. Which means, since these proteins are in the way, you're going to start having an invagination or an infolding of the surface of that water. Right? Because you're losing water. And the more water evaporates, the more intense that curvature gets. That curvature, the more you make that extreme, the more it wants to bounce back, because it's a much more stable situation to have a straighter surface than it is to have this curved surface, because of surface tension of water. And what is surface tension caused by? What property of water? The same property of water that gives water all of its special properties, pretty much, which is polarity. Water is a polar molecule. And so that causes this curvature to want to straighten out. But if it straightens out, the only way it can do that is to pull liquid water molecules toward the surface, right? Which is to the right in this cartoon. And when you pull water molecules, they're all hydrogen bonded to each other, right? Because of polarity. So they're all attracted to each other by hydrogen bonding. So when you pull on some, you're going to drag the ones behind them along. That force of attraction between water molecules, since they're all the same kind of particles, is cohesion. There are cohesive forces and there are adhesive forces. Cohesion is attraction between the same kinds of particles, and adhesion is attraction between different kinds. So the evaporation removes water molecules, and then the cohesive property of water, when this straightens out, is to drag water molecules along. And this is kind of like a freight train. At the leaf surface, at the top, that's like the engine of the train, pulling on everything behind it, right? And the hitches between the cars are the hydrogen bonds that form between water molecules because of their polarity. Well, this also happens within the xylem. So in slide 21, we can see this continuing. As the engine, which is really caused by evaporation, is pulling from the top, all the water molecules are being pulled behind it. They're also helped, though, by being attracted to the walls of the xylem. That's, though, adhesion, because the walls of the xylem are not water molecules. They're different kinds of molecules. They're also polar, though, so they're attracted as well. So the combination of adhesion and cohesion means there's an entire And in the case of very tall trees, a very, very long train of water molecules all being pulled from the top. And that is an enormous amount of force that's required to do that, especially in the case of a sequoia tree, for instance. Tallest organisms that have ever lived. The higher you get, the more gravity is fighting you, right? If you imagine just lifting a chain, the first few links don't get heavy, but if you have an enormous chain and you keep lifting it off the floor, it gets heavier and heavier, right? Because you're lifting more and more chains. So eventually gravity will win out if you make it too high, which will break one of the hitches between the cars of the train, basically, and cause a cavity to form in here. The rest of it at the top can go along, but it's not going to pull the one at the bottom anymore, and that will kill the tree. So it's probably the case that sequoias have evolved to be just about as tall as they possibly can be and get away with winning against gravity. 22, almost done. 22, I want to talk about the stomata that I've told you were the holes in the leaves. Really important because the leaf is otherwise pretty waterproof. But if you had it waterproof everywhere, you wouldn't be able to get CO2 in or O2 out or water vapor out. So there has to be holes in leaves, and those are called stomata, plural of stoma. The stoma itself is not really a structure. It's just an opening, kind of like the pupil of your eye is not a structure. It's formed by the iris, the structure surrounding it, the opening. In the case of a stoma, the surrounding structure is made up of two cells called guard cells. They guard the entrance called the stoma. And they are specially modified compared to the normal cells of the leaf to change shape in such a way that the stoma will either open or close. In the upper left, you can see how this arrangement works. In a typical cell, the cell wall thickness is about the same on all sides, not for a guard cell. In the guard cell, notice the cell wall is much thicker on the side of the cell facing the stoma. The other sides are much thinner cell wall, the bluish material here. And also notice by these lines here that there are proteins, part of the cytoskeleton, that tether one side of the cell wall to the other. All right? Now, imagine a balloon. Once again, I use a balloon as an analogy. In a normal balloon, the latex thickness is about the same in all parts of the balloon. So if you give it some pressure, it's just going to become spherical because it's going to bulge in all directions equally. But if you had a weird balloon that had really thick rubber or latex on one side and thin on the other, and you start pressurizing it, it's going to bulge outward here and not where it's thick, right? Now imagine that inside the balloon you had little wires or strings or something connecting the thick part to the thin part over here. When you start bulging it, that's going to pull on the thick part, right? And make it cave in as it gets dragged away by the bulging part. That's what's happening here. So when this cell bulges, the thin cell wall is what actually bulges away from the opening, and the tethers drag the thick part along for the ride, causing it to invaginate, causing the opening. You see that? You see what I mean there? So that makes sense, hopefully, meaning that the opening is caused by bulging of the cell. What bulges the cell? Osmosis. Uptake of water is going to cause this thing to open up. Which, by the way, also makes sense, because if there's plenty of water, that's the time you want to have your stomata open, because you're not in danger of drying out. You want to get them open for photosynthesis, and you can afford the loss of water. But anyway, osmosis is what causes the bulging, but how does the plant control whether or not osmosis occurs? Once again, you have pumps come into play. Specifically, pumps that cause, well, it's the pumping of potassium ions, K plus. By active transport, when the cell wants to open the stoma, by active transport, so it's spending ATP, potassium ions get pumped from the exterior fluid into the cell. That means the inside of the cell is now less watery because you're adding solute to it, right? And so the exterior is now more watery, and water by osmosis is going to follow that potassium ion into the cell, and that's what bulges it. And when it turns those pumps off, the reverse will happen because potassium will diffuse back out. That will destroy the gradient for potassium, and it will also eliminate the osmotic gradient, so water will come back out, and that will undo the bulging, and the stoma will close. Here we have several examples of plants that have evolved mechanisms to deal with some pretty demanding environmental factors familiar to us, which the thing that they're dealing with here is a shortage of water. So these are desert adaptations. A desert, by definition, is a place where water is scarce. And ocotillos you see growing around here, people have them in their yard, and if people move into the valley and never seen them before, and it's the wrong time of the year, they would probably say, who killed that thing, or why in the hell would you plant this thing in your yard, because they look like nothing for a lot of the year. But then they, all at once, they bloom. There's a couple times a year when it gets wet, and that's when they take their chance. There's not enough water for them to have leaves on all year like normal plants do, because leaves do a very good job of catching sunlight, but they're also huge sites of loss of water. So if you don't have enough water to go around, then you want to get rid of those leaves. Now, doing that will keep you alive because it'll save water, but it will also make you unable to photosynthesize. So they basically go dormant and live on their store of food that they made when they were photosynthesizing, when they had leaves. And when they sense that water coming in twice a year, they explode in a lot of leaves, get all their photosynthesis for the year done, and then live on the store. Oleanders are also common around here, and they actually don't look like arid-adapted plants. They look like they would lose a lot of water with their leaves. But when you look closely microscopically, you can see why they don't. They save a lot of water, actually. Because their stomata are not right at the surface of a leaf like they are in most leaves. The stomata are within little crypts or cave-like structures in the leaf. So here's where the opening is, but it's not on the surface. If you have wind coming, which exacerbates evaporation, the windier it is, the more you lose water. The wind on a normal leaf would draw a bunch of water right out of that surface stoma. But since you have a little cave here, the wind outside here is going to be brisk, but it's not going to swirl much in here, in this little cave. Just like if you hopped into a cave, you wouldn't feel the wind. And therefore, oleanders don't lose nearly as much water. And the old man cactus, they don't have to be old, and they certainly aren't men, but they're called that, of course, because they're gray hair, which really isn't hair. Here you have modified leaves that are no longer doing the work of other cacti, other cactus modified leaves, which are to protect them, right, from things that could eat them. They're spiny. These are soft. So it's not about that. It's just that they're trying to stay cool. It's white hair or white spines so that it reflects as much light as possible. There's plenty of light for photosynthesis, but with that light also comes heat. And the more you heat up, the more water you lose. So they're still getting plenty of light for photosynthesis, but they're intentionally reflecting a lot of that light away so it doesn't heat them up. Like mirrors, basically. 24. We've talked about secondary active transport before. That's exactly what you have happening here on the right. Right? This is the primary active transport spending ATP to create the proton gradient. Then that proton gradient is used for secondary active transport of sucrose into the cell. Well, on the left, you can see that sucrose, which is produced by the leaves by photosynthesis, can travel, it can leave cells and get in the apoplast. But by secondary active transport, the cells can pump it back into the cells that make up these sieve tubes that we were talking about, that make up phloem, keeping it in the phloem so that it can be transported as phloem sap, sugary phloem sap, to the rest of the plant. And along the same lines, I think this is the last slide, 25, we can see the phloem and the xylem working together. Xylem and phloem are running side by side. Now, the xylem sap is mostly water. It has solutes in it, but it's very watery. The phloem sap is very much more viscous and much more sugary, because that's where the sucrose is. And notice that they're going in opposite directions, which helps in this relationship. Because, well, a couple things going on here. At the sucrose source, which is where it's produced, that's at the leaf, for instance, sucrose is continuously being produced because photosynthesis is producing carbohydrates. And the more sucrose gets produced, the more it builds up. It's pressurizing that phloem tube simply by adding more and more sucrose, right? So it's pressurizing it at that end. And it's lower pressure down here, so that's part of why the flow goes the way it does through the phloem tube. Just because of pressure. At the sink end, like a root cell, for instance, that needs the sucrose, it's taking it in. Taking that sucrose in. And therefore, it's doing the opposite. It's reducing the pressure down here by removing sucrose continuously. And therefore, that maintains the gradient and allows the flow to continue from the source to the sink. Okay, that would happen even on its own, if it's only the phloem there. But the xylem gets into the play and helps out as well. At the source end, at the top, some of the water that's in the xylem can leak out of the xylem and into the phloem by osmosis, which makes sense because this is very sugary in the phloem, right? And therefore not as watery. So the water should want to go where it's not as watery. And that uptake of water also helps to pressurize that end, and so that forces the phloem downward in the picture too. And then at the other end, the sink end, not only is the sucrose being taken up, but water is leaving and going into the xylem, and that causes the negative pressure as well. So it keeps, you know, you might think that it's very difficult to push this syrupy phloem sap through the phloem, and it is. It doesn't happen unless you have these pressure gradients in play. So let me make sure that's it. Yes, it is.